You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. We're continuing our look at the book, The Mind of the CEO by Jeffrey E. Garton. Last show, we were looking at the section Being Global. Diversity may be essential to building the intellectual capacity of a company to develop and exploit markets. But realistically, a tension exists between diversity and a unified corporate culture that enables a company to efficiently execute strategies, communicate among its component parts, differentiate itself from other companies in the same business, and not run afoul of its core ethical standards. Unless carefully managed, extensive diversity could lead to corporate chaos. Striking the right balance represents a new frontier in management. Hiroshi Okuda, former president and now chairman of Toyota, came to Yale in the year 1997. His visit illustrated that the search for diversity is further complicated by the fact that most CEOs are deeply rooted in their own national cultures. I first met him in 1991 when I was an investment banker and he was in charge of all of Toyota's finances. It was a moment I'll never forget. A colleague and I flew from New York to Toyota City near Nagoya for a one-hour meeting with him. The plane arrived on time, but we were snarled in traffic and arrived 30 minutes late, leaving us just half an hour to make the presentation. My colleague took the lead in explaining our proposal. Toyota should invest some money in highly complex investments known as financial derivatives, which at the time were a novel idea in Japan. It took 20 minutes to make the pitch. Okuda listened intently. When it came time to respond, he demonstrated that he was not a traditional Japanese executive. He did not simply nod politely, did not ask a few basic questions to make us feel that he was interested in what we had to say. Instead, he burst into a broad smile, which was immediately contagious. Quote, "You're kidding, right?" unquote, is a rough translation of his opening remarks. "I didn't understand a word of what you said," he continued, "but in a way that made us laugh too." When I became the dean at Yale some 5 years later, I had it on my mind to introduce this iconoclastic Japanese leader to our students. He had never spoken in an American university, and his staff were nervous. "What if he gets a nasty question?" they asked. "Well, he'll just have to handle it." Knowing that Okuda would be a big hit under any circumstances, I suggested that he sit on a stool on a slightly raised platform and have a give and take with the students, some 200 of them. Very reluctantly, the Toyota staff agreed. Okuda gave a short talk from behind the podium and then moved to a stool in what might have been unprecedented informality for a Japanese CEO. A student asked him if it was true that Japanese universities don't encourage independent thinking. Yes, that is the case, said Okuda. Well, replied the student, how do you, as a major employer, feel about that? Doesn't it undermine the potential for new ideas, creativity, and entrepreneurship? Quote, I admire your system in the United States, Okuda said, but you have to recognize that Japan is very different. I'm not saying one system is better than the other. They are just very different. We at Toyota would have a lot of problems with entry-level people who are too unstructured in their thinking. We'd rather train them our way. In terms of our overall performance as a car company, Toyota can always do better, of course. But all in all, our educational system hasn't worked too badly for us. The audience was impressed with Okuda's directness and sincerity. But when I interviewed him a year later in Tokyo, he lamented Japanese insularity. In fact, both he and Minoru Mikihara, the stately Harvard-educated chairman of the Mitsubishi Corporation, emphasized their concern that the cultural conformity in Japanese companies was debilitating disadvantages that would increasingly handicap the global positioning of their companies. In their minds, overcoming the problem would at best be a long-term affair. An increasing diversity of talent will be the overwhelming competitive advantage of the future. Companies that put in place the policies and structures to make this happen will be the winners. For as the world continues to open up, so will markets that no one can today foresee. These will range from global businesses for niche products to local markets in the interior of China, India, Indonesia, Brazil, Russia, and many other countries. Big companies need antennae that they have only begun to gauge what local people in new markets want. How to market the product or service, how to tailor financing and delivery precisely to local needs. No computer will provide this information. Only people can. And the more diverse the opportunities, the more diverse the talent of a CEO needs. If a company is to live up to its worldwide potential, the diversity of an organization should reflect the diversity of international environments. The ability to relate to individual communities in the global economy, whether they are defined by geographical boundaries, income, or ethnic relationships, is becoming increasingly crucial because of the internet too. Never before have customers been able to shop the world for precisely what they want, and never before have sellers been under more pressure to customize their products and services. So here's the irony. The same technology that is making the world economy more integrated and more navigable is also enhancing its segmentation and diversity. Diversity is relevant to all layers of a company, the workforce, the top management, the board of directors, national preferences, language barriers and prejudices being what they are. We may not see the emergence of a truly diverse companies for many years, if ever. This won't mean the end of globalization, of course, but companies that remain insular in their mindset and their capabilities will be at a severe disadvantage. A great multinational company ought to be a knowledge factory, gathering information and insights from all corners of the world, applying them in various combinations in other locations. John Brown, CEO of BP, understands this very well. A petroleum engineer whose entire career has been spent in the same company, Brown may be the chief executive who is the most articulate about the nature of global business, the opportunities and limitations of corporate power, the role of companies in society at large, not to mention global corporate strategies themselves. Quote, on the other hand, we understand that everything is local, he said to me. Customs are local, customers are local, communications are local. But the purpose of a great company is that every local action should create learning that we can use elsewhere. As a company operating in so many countries, that is the great advantage that we have to leverage. A global firm ought to be able to gain advantage over others by taking what it learns in one part of the world and doing something elsewhere it could never have done. The question for CEOs is, quote, how do you enhance learning throughout the organization? Having the right people, a core of employees reflecting true global diversity, is one vital element. So is using the internet to access and distribute the enormous amount of information that exists within a firm. Companies such as Merrill Lynch have intranets, which documents their thousands of deals around the world and allows their investment bankers to learn from their colleagues' successes and failures. But this is just the beginning. A great multinational company will examine every one of its assets around the world, its factories, research labs, distribution outlets, marketing teams, partners big and small, and it will treat them not only as overseas subsidiaries, branches, and facilities, but also as global learning centers. These centers will view the world through local eyes, reporting to top management on how to find new ways to penetrate world markets from the vantage point of what was considered to be a periphery, be it Charlotte, São Paulo, or Warsaw, but which is now just another global center. CEOs and their teams will also have to be supreme trend spotters. A new fashion craze in Spain could quickly end up influencing retailing, say, perhaps in the United States or in Japan. A new manufacturing technique developed in Scandinavia could rapidly be transferred to the United States or to Japan. Those leaders who can see these kinds of developments in one part of the globe early and experiment with them elsewhere will create the value for customers. However, the right communication systems have to be in place, the culture of cooperation must exist throughout the company, and financial incentives must encourage managers to share information and to work together on the execution of global deals. Leveraging global can include experimenting in countries that provide environments that are far different from one's home base. Even before U.S. banks were able to be investment banks and deposit takers at the same time, when Depression-era laws mandated separation of the two activities in the United States, they experimented with investment banking products in London, where there were no such legal restrictions. Today, General Motors is using a state-of-the-art stamping press and ultra-lean workforce in Gravataí, Brazil, to experiment with a kind of modular assembly method that would be a radical departure from the way cars have been built. The process involves suppliers from all over the country. It would have been highly difficult, probably impossible, to break new ground this way in a traditional, rigidly unionized environment like that of the United States or Germany. All this is easier to describe than do. Top management has to be strewn all around the world, and yet they have to be a closely knit team at the same time. Otherwise, good ideas from, say, Bangkok or Caracas, especially those very valuable ones that break the mold, will never reach the CEO's office. You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby, and you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenary, Instructor of Future Studies at Simon Fraser University. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
With thousands of homeless animals entering SPCA shelters each year, pet overpopulation is a serious problem in BC, but it's one you can help prevent. Spay or neuter your companion animal today. From our perspective, every homeless animal on our streets or in our shelters is one too many. For more information on spaying and neutering initiatives, visit the BC SPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenary, professional futurist. Welcome back. We are looking at the book by Jeffrey E. Garton, The Mind of the CEO. And we're still looking at the chapter, Being Global. How to organize a company for global operations. Even the most internationally experienced business leaders continue to experiment, for no one has the right formula. CEOs may in fact be underestimating the extent of the organizational transformation that will need to take place in the best firms. They talk about the tension between organizing a company along product and geographical lines. They are worried about missing opportunities for growth by merger or by acquisition. These are important concerns, but they are just the tip of the iceberg. Three examples of what CEOs are doing today illustrate some of the current thinking about organizations and how much further there is to go. Michael Bonsignore is a Naval Academy graduate and an engineer who speaks four languages. He has lived in five countries and ran Honeywell's European operations before becoming its chairman and CEO. While he considers the globalization of Honeywell one of his major accomplishments, he admits that getting the organizational structure right is a never-ending effort. We meet in his Minneapolis office shortly before he moves to Morristown, New Jersey, to take control of the enlarged company that includes Allied Signal. He told me, quote, "When I first became CEO, the big issue was one of mindset. We had to get the words domestic and international out of our jargon. I can remember all those internal debates about how much of our sales come from outside the US, and I tried to convert that line of thinking so that we looked at the world as a place to do our business. I worked to convince everyone that we should make our investments wherever the world they would be optimized. We put worldwide teams together. We brought the various representations from all over the regions of the world together to plan our engineering and manufacturing. We would no longer build a factory in France at the same time we were building a factory in Singapore, both of which would have done overlapping things. But for Bonsignore, even the right way of thinking about being global didn't solve the organizational questions of how to do it. Quote, "We have tried a lot of organizational structures, tight, loose, central, decentralized, etc. We're still working on it. I've always likened this to a job that is never done. If you take comfort that you have the right structure in place, you are probably in trouble." Mark Moody Stewart runs Royal Dutch Shell, one of the oldest multinational enterprises anywhere in the world. A PhD in geology from Cambridge University in 1966, He has spent his entire professional life at Shell with assignments in countries such as Oman, Brunei, Nigeria, Australia, Spain, Turkey, Malaysia, and the UK. In the late 1990s, he presided over a reorganization of the corporation designed to align its focus with at least two global trends. One was the rise of global firms to which Royal Dutch Shell wished to sell their products, airlines, and auto manufacturers, for example. These companies want to deal with one or just a few suppliers, not one in each region in which they operate. The same goes for their advertising and financial requirements. The second trend is the rise of the global consumer, an international middle class with broadly similar tastes. To appeal to both international companies and consumers, Royal Dutch Shell decided to break down its national fiefdoms and create global systems that could see the entire world through the lens of products and not geography. Rather than organizing to sell petrochemicals to one customer in France and one in Japan, the Anglo/Dutch company structured itself to serve the needs of, say, Airbus Industries on a global scale. With this structure, Royal Dutch/Shell had a more streamlined view of the world and could now move quickly as well. Quote, we used to have a kind of feudal system, and a fantastically successful machine it was, to match the time in which it operated. Moody Stewart told me in his London office, quote, it was an era of strong national boundaries, reinforced by all kinds of trade barriers. We set up what you might call a family of national companies, such as, for example, Shell Singapore, Shell Brazil, Shell Oil in the U.S., and we built the company on the basis of companies aggregated into regions. But the world doesn't work like that anymore. You want to keep the autonomy and freedom of action of the smaller unit, but the basis on which those units are built changes from being a national unit to being a customer or business-based unit. So now we have a global chemicals group or a global aviation group, better to serve our global customers. And these same customers are served around the world by the same unit. We deliver better because we have a global scale in which the product and the right global alignment of people. One of the most interesting works in progress is that I heard about when it comes to organizing for international business involves Stan Sheikh, chairman and co-founder of Acer, a manufacturer of computer equipment and one of Taiwan's largest and best-known companies. Sheikh founded the company in 1976 and took it public in 1988. His aim was to go beyond the typical pattern of manufacturing in Taiwan, copying what Western companies do, and instead to make original products under the Acer name. His big markets have been developing countries, especially China and India, although Acer also sells in Europe and, to a lesser extent, the United States. From the beginning, Sheikh touted his ambition to create a new model for multinational management. To expand internationally, Sheikh built a network of companies around the world that cooperated with one another but were virtually independent. They shared the Acer brand. The Acer Central Management in Taiwan took small stakes in each other's Acer firms. The theory was that each unit could be publicly listed in the company in which it operated and remain especially close to customers in those local markets. The hurdle was that to create one culture and set of standards throughout many companies. This required a strong sense of common mission and a powerful but collective management team throughout the empire. Sheikh bolstered the sense of teamwork by spreading stock ownership and incentives throughout his 23,000 workers, becoming the first major CEO in Taiwan to do so. Sheath began this experiment in 1995 based on a combination of old and new ideas. On the one hand, it resembled the informal web of business empires built and controlled by Chinese families whose members lived throughout Southeast Asia. On the other hand, it anticipated the Internet's model of a decentralized network. However, Xi's plan seems to have worked with mixed success. How much of the problem is due to management deficiencies and how much is reflected in the cutthroat computer industry itself is not clear. By 1999, Acer was changing its product mix to include software and multimedia products. It was building an incubator for new ideas in Taiwan in the form of a special industrial park for venues that could produce creative ideas in the Silicon Valley mode. Xi'an, still trying to find the right mix of organization and products and a global niche for non-Japanese Asian-based companies. Quote, "We're seeking a structure that gives us extreme flexibility to move quickly and to respond to local conditions in a highly creative way," he told me, clearly determined to keep trying to find the right formula. Since my interviews took place, two of the world's largest international companies found themselves in circumstances that further illustrate how even the biggest and most experienced multinationals can flounder in their efforts to get the organizational structure just right. Let's look at Coca-Cola, for example. Ever since the death in 1997 of Coke's legendary leader, Roberto Gazzuerta, the company has had problems. Recession in Asia, financial turmoil in Russia and Latin America, health and safety issues in Europe, diversity problems at home, crisis after crisis after crisis, and these have overtaken the company. It has proved too much for Gazzuerta's immediate successor, Douglas Ivester, who was forced to resign in early 2000. He was succeeded by Douglas Daft. Part of Daft's calculation was that Coca-Cola had become much too centralized and had lost its ability to understand local markets. Quote, "For a couple of years, the world was moving in one direction and we were moving in the other," he wrote in the Financial Times in March 2000. "The world was demanding greater flexibility and responsiveness and local sensitivity, while we were further decentralizing decision-making and standardizing our practice. We must now lead a Coca-Cola business system that not only has the professional expertise with management systems and capital structures required for success in the globalized economy, but also is also what was able to act nimbly and with great sensitivity in every local community where our blends are sold. The next big evolutionary step is going global, and now that has to be local." Daft says Coke's operations will now be guided by three principles. First, think local, act local. Second, focus on marketing, outsource everything else. Third, be a model citizen in every country. "We must remember," he wrote, we do not do business in markets. We do business in societies." We will continue looking at this in future shows, so please stay tuned. You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby, and Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.